Kolkata Institute, K. Narayan, well, he's now in Chennai, moved on, and Sandeep Trivedi. This approach is a little bit different and sort of complementary to the talks of Thomas and Ben, which you heard yesterday. So what I'll do first is to give you an overall impression of the scenario which we are aiming for. So I'll call this the setup. Our context is asymptotically ADS5 cross S5 geometries. And we will use, and our entire discussion is in Poincaré coordinates. And the way we would like to set up the problem is as follows. So you start at, say, t equal to minus infinity. And let me draw, do this. We will consider evolution time-dependent backgrounds in ADS5 cross S5, which can depend on real time, and which can also depend on null time. So it's some one of the light cone coordinates. I'll for this part of the discussion, I'll treat them in a unified fashion, call both of them times. Okay. So when this time is in the far past, we will put the gauge theory in a vacuum. We will choose a coupling constant of the gauge theory, which I'll call G Young Mills bar, such that the Etoupe coupling is very large. This is, of course, the trivial situation, and we know what is the bulk description of this state. It's the ADS5 cross S5 geometry. At t equal to minus 10 to the 500, which seems to be a good number in string theory. What we will do, we will slowly turn on a source on the gauge theory, by which I mean I deform the original Hamiltonian of the gauge theory by a time-dependent perturbation. So I get a Young-Mills Hamiltonian, which is a function of time, which becomes a function of time or the null time because you have added some perturbation to the source. And at this time, the source is weak. The specific kind of sources we will talk about are in fact the ones which correspond to providing a slight time dependence to the coupling constants. For example, and this is the example we we have explored, G Young Mills becomes a function of time. What this means is that what you have added to the Hamiltonian is a term which is proportional to the Lagrangian density and so on, and with a coefficient which is 1 upon G Young Mills square time minus 1 upon G Young Mills bar square. This is the constant coupling which satisfies this condition. Since at this time the source is weak and it is slowly varying, we also, it's the standard ADS-CFT dictionary tells us what is the description of this in the bulk. And the standard ADS-CFT dictionary tells you that what it corresponds to is a non-normalizable deformation . This is the source term. I mean, if you add this to
infinity? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, sort of slowly turn it on at infinity.
So one over g squared is
turning. That's right. That's right. And this is some constant number. The g young is with a bar is some constant number.
Then the sign is a bit peculiar. I mean, you're in that's fine. You're in Lorentzian.
Depending on what.
So the second term is the standard one.
Second term is the standard one. The first term is what I added. It's a non-normalizable deformation of radius 5 plus S5. That means still the coupling constant is pretty large. The effective coupling constant, which is given by G Young Mill square as a function of time times n, is still very large. The supergravity approximation is still pretty good at t equal to minus 10 to the 500. And we know what this deformation is. It corresponds to turning on a dilaton, on a non-trivial dilaton. We shall call phi of t. Okay? So let's proceed. T equal to minus 10 to the 40. All the way from here, the gauge theory evolves in time according to this deformed Hamiltonian. So this evolves state evolves according to this new deformed Hamiltonian. And so long as the coupling is large enough, we know that the dilaton is going to evolve, or the supergravity field is going to evolve according to the supergravity equations of motion. Of course, what this means is that the dilaton will start back reacting with the other fields in supergravity. So you have to solve the coupled set of equations, Einstein equations and the dilaton equations and the phi form and whatever you have in the theory. In the Hamiltonian.
Right, and then there must be an explicit time-dependent integral solid oxide.
That's non-normalizable information of ADS factors.
Right, but where does he? Again, so there's some explicit time dependence that appears.
Yeah, so what we are, on the right hand side, what we are going to describe is a solution of supergravity, which is a time dependent solution.
Right, but the action for supergravity contains, again, an explicit time dependent term.
No, the action of supergravity doesn't contain any explicit time dependent term.
It's in the boundary conditions.
It's in the boundary conditions, right.
Okay, but on the gauge theory side, you have an explicit time dependence in the action.
That's correct. Right.
Why is there no explicit?
So the standard. So let me call the standard ADS CFT dictionary. So ADS CFT dictionary tells you that if I take ADS 5 plus S 5, and so let's take in the limit when supergravity is good. So then if I consider solutions of supergravity, which are non-normalizable, that means which have a non-zero tail on the boundary, these correspond not to the Young-Mills theory you started out with, but the Young-Mills theory plus a term, which you can write down using that dictionary. On the other hand, if you did consider a solution which is normalizable, so that none of the fields have a tail on the boundary, what it corresponds to is exciting a state in the original Young-Mills theory. So we are doing here the following. Okay, so other fields are turned on. So you solve supergravity equations of motion. At some point, say t equal to 0, we will have a scenario when this coupling constant, which I have chosen for you, I've just given you a time-dependent coupling constant, becomes very, very small. So even though G bar Young Mill square times N is very large, the G Young Mill square function of T times N is very small, And we know that this is a situation where supergravity should not be trusted anymore. If at all, it has a dual. The dual is some string theory in which we have no idea what that string theory is. So what would that cause? How would that be signaled in the supergravity? What we will find that it's going to be signaled in supergravity by curvatures and or tidal forces becoming large. In such a situation, it is meaningless to, yes.
Mills.
Well, it's becoming small because the Young-Mills coupling itself is becoming very small. It's going to hit close to zero. In this situation, of course, it's meaningless to try to evolve the system any further using supergravity equations of motion. So you give up. But that's typical of what a singularity is. A singularity is something when you start off with some smooth initial data in general relativity, and you come to a situation where all hell breaks loose, and you don't know what to do. On the gauge theory side, however, the coupling constant is becoming weak. In fact, what this means in supergravity is that the dilaton, and this is a typical profile which we will show, this e to the phi is, in fact, the coupling constant of the Young-Mills theory as a function of time or a function of x plus, has a feature which is sort of like that. It is in this region that the exponential of the dilaton has become extremely small. In fact, you could cook up such that it becomes, in fact, exactly zero. In that region, supergravity certainly doesn't make any sense. However, you might hope that because what you have landed up is a weakly coupled gauge theory, you might be able to say something about the time evolution in some controlled fashion. Of course, it's not as easy as it sounds. This thing, similar scenarios, for example, have been put forward by Ben and collaborators, something which goes by the name of matrix string theory. A lot of our work was sort of inspired by, you know, that kind of thing, except we wanted to get something in the ADS-CFT framework. So we're going to try to examine to the best of our ability in this situation whether at all you can use the weakly coupled gauge theory to evolve further and ask, maybe at some much later time, the coupling constant again grows large, and again, there is a supergravity, and therefore space-time interpretation reemerges. So the way we are approaching the problem is not to ask, what is it in closed string theory which is turning on or off near singularities? So pretty much like the other works which you have heard before, we are asking, we are assuming the ADS-CFT correspondence, we are using the fact that near that region where curvatures are very large or tidal forces are very large, you can use the language of gauge theory. You're actually describing the same system, but you're using the language of gauge theory to say something about the time evolution. Of course, I've described it in this fashion, but that's not what we really do. What we really do is to do it in reverse. Namely, we find supergravity solutions of this type. And so in the rest of the talk, I'll describe several such implementations of this scenario and tell you what we could learn from this entire setup. Okay, any questions?
Just to make a connection to what we heard yesterday. So here, there is an explicit time dependence that's added to the Gaze theory.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have any such.
Yeah.
So now, what's the status of the ADS-CFT correspondence? What is known about ADS-CFT rigorously?
What is known about it? Up to -10^-40, so long as that coupling that coupling constant is strong, we know almost everything about ADS-CFT. In the following sense, that we know what does it correspond to in supergravity, namely it's turning on this dilaton. As the coupling constant grows very weak, we don't know anything. I mean, we take the attitude that we take the gauge theory to define the system.
Right. So, but I'm just asking about at very early times.
Right.
Is the correspondence rigorous, or are you sort of extending the ADS-CFT?
Well, it's rigorous in the same sense of almost everything we know about ADS-CFT is rigorous. I mean, what one does is that it says exactly what I wrote there, that turning on a source like this is like a non-normalizable deformation. And then what you do is you go to the gauge theory and calculate some correlation functions. And then you compare it with some boundary correlators in supergravity. They are in different regimes of applicability. But then, there is this magic word called supersymmetry, which tells you that this correlation functions are not normalized. So you check that the result is actually valid for those correlation functions, and then you declare that, the places where you can't do the calculation is valid. Okay. ADS-CFT is emerging more as a definition.
Maybe Robert's question is, are you treating the same theory as was treated yesterday, or are you treating
No, it's a different one. Because it's different theory.
In your case, ADS is no longer a solution, right? Once you deform.
Asymptotically, it's a solution. I mean, in asymptotic time.
Hmm. Exactly. But not along the way. Whereas in our case, ADS is still a solution.
That's right. So their case is like having a more dynamical implementation of this kind of thing, where the time dependence is coming because an operator is rolling down that shift.
Right.
Our case is a little bit different, but
source.
I think on the flip side, we have managed to have a situation where the gauge theory is weakly coupled. So in that sense, it's a kind of complement. Okay, so I'll now proceed to describe some of these solutions.
Can I just ask whether you had to pick T to be a null coordinate?
No, I'll describe both.
Okay.
In fact, set of papers was about null coordinates, our most recent paper, and the one which we hope will put out in a couple of weeks is about time-dependent I'll mention some results from there. So just to give you a good impression of this scenario where things are pretty much under control, but they're not as interesting from the cosmology point of view, but it does address some problems of singularities, or singularities which are null in the bulk. So without further ado, let me write down the solution, which is quite typical. The solution is written like this. Y. So there are two of these. So this is I'll add it here.
we're not going to do anything to the S5. So when I keep writing down metrics later on, I'll just omit the S5. So the addition here, the deformation here, is a term which is sort of like a plane wave type, which has an object which is the derivative of a function phi, which I have taken to be any function I like. With phi to be any function, and the phi form field strength given by the standard, where the star is defined according to that metric, this is a solution of supergravity. Okay? Now, the kind of phi, as I said, we're interested in are like the type which I have given above. So as you can see there, that e to the phi becomes very small at some point. So we will take e to the phi very small at some arbitrarily chosen point, which I'll call y plus equal to 0. But since all the derivatives of e to the phi are smooth at that point, that immediately means that the derivative of phi has to be necessarily singular. Okay. So at this point, however, because of this very peculiar dependence on null coordinates, it so happens that if you calculate the invariants which are made from just the curvature tensor, all those things are always bounded and equal to the radius values. It's some triviality which follows from the fact that you only have plus indices downstairs and no tensor with plus indices upstairs, so there's nothing to contract with. That doesn't mean that there is no singularity. In fact, you could consider, and I'll not write down those equations, you could consider geodesics in this kind of space-time, and you can calculate what the because e to the phi hit a zero.
Hits zero.
Yeah. Well, or small. I mean, zero are extremely small, so this thing becomes very large. Right. And derivative of e to the phi is finite.
Why do you want the derivative of e to the phi to be finite?
I can choose any phi I like. So I have chosen of e to the phi, which is of that form. You know, where, I mean, our main thing is that we want the coupling constant of the gauge theory to be always bounded, finite, and hitting a point where the coupling constant is very small, in some smooth fashion. So this is an example of that, but since, you know, like derivative of phi is what? It's like something like this.
Yeah.
And so that becomes large.
Was this a reason to want it to be large? I mean, you could have it as small as you like.
That's what the singularity is. You can choose a phi, anything you like. And this can describe, you know, a small deformation of radius 5. But we want to describe deformations where you approach a singularity. That's what the singularity is. Okay. So this is a singularity because you can consider two geodesics in such space-time.
And you can calculate first. In fact, there are null geodesics in the space-time. And you can check that these null geodesics reach this point in some finite affine parameter. You can calculate the tidal force between two of these null geodesics, and you can find that the tidal force, the magnitude of the acceleration, is in fact again proportional to the derivative of phi whole square. So the tidal forces diverge. Now, when I use the words like diverge or things like that, what I mean is become very large. You know, in this case, I mean, it's quite controllable, so I can use that terminology. So this is a singularity of a genuine type. And from the supergravity point of view,
yes. So what we are going to do is calculate the acceleration between. So let suppose this is the tangent vector to one of the geodesics. So you which are so this is the tangent vector, and let me call x the separation vector. So the acceleration is given by mu. I might have messed up indices, so let's see. X. Then we put everything down here. So let me put a psi here, lambda. Mu, lambda, then put nu, and then put sigma. Okay, something like that. So the mod square of this. So that's like a.
But is it independent of frame?
Yeah, so the square of that. Is, I mean, so I take contract A is B sigma.
I mean,
sigma.
File frame.
No, but it's a physical force between two geodesics. So
should I work in straight frame or?
Everything is Einstein frame. Okay. So we are all, when you write metrics or anything, it's always in Einstein. No, it's not independent of that. Okay. The point about this kind of solution is that, as you can see, written in this form, this space-time has a boundary, which is at w equal to 0, and at the boundary, the singularity, or whatever it is, becomes arbitrarily weak. In fact, when you look at the standard correspondence in ADS-CFT, you do the following. You take a metric, which is the four dimensional components of the metric, which I can write as a function of x and phi. These are the coordinates on the boundary. This is the ADS coordinate. And you can always expand that. And so on, put in overall 1 upon w square, and the result is that this part is going to be the metric of the boundary theory, because that's the metric on which the gauge theory lives. The net subleading part is in fact determined in terms of this by the equations of motion. If you look at this part, there are two parts of it. One is the traceless divergence part of it. That is determined by the equations of motion, but the rest is not. That's a freedom in, that's the other undetermined parameter in the, what is it called? Differential equations.
Integration constants,
right. So the other undetermined integration. That's good, actually. Integration constant. So turning on a part of this, which is not the trace and not the divergence, actually means that you are, that's what I'm calling a normalizable mode. That means you have excited a state of the gauge theory. And as you can look at in this metric, so far as the metric is concerned, the boundary metric is still flat. However, this is only a function of y plus and not a function of w. So therefore, the scalar field certainly has a tail on the boundary, and so it is indeed a non-normalizable deformation of ADS 5 cos S 5. You can do some other checks of this. Now, I started when? 9:15 or something?
9:20, so it's just half an hour, not too bad.
Good. I'll erase this because that wouldn't be necessary. Now, it turns out.
Yeah.
there is a form of the of this metric which will be useful to pursue when you look for actually time dependent solutions rather than null solutions. Okay, and the buzzword in this are Penrose, Brown, and O transformations. And I'll describe what are these in these coordinates. It turns out that if you take this metric and perform a coordinate transformation from y plus minus this to z x plus minus x, where and the remaining where f satisfies the equation, it's actually a nice equation. Prime denotes derivative with respect to x plus or y plus, which are the same thing. If I just perform this coordinate transformation, that metric becomes or in other words, in these coordinates, there is a different boundary, which is not the same boundary as w equal to 0. I mean, naively, it looks like w equal to 0 is z equal to 0. But in the ADS safety correspondence, what you really got to do is to go not quite to the boundary, putting an ultraviolet cutoff, which corresponds to putting an ultraviolet cutoff in the gauge theory. So if I look at the new boundary, which I call z equal to 0, that boundary is not flat, but it is conformally flat. And in the kind of situations we are considering, that conformal factor, in fact, goes to 0 as you approach you know, that point, which we are calling the singularity. When I come to talk about the dual gauge theory, I'm not going to use this boundary to define the dual gauge theory. I could do that, and in fact, it is possible to do that, but I'll not do that because, well, I'll tell you if you ask a question. Okay.
So there's a choice on a conformal anomaly?
Yes, so the point is that when things are only dependent on y plus, there is no conformal anomaly. So that's where you can go between the two, okay? For time-dependent cases, there would be a conformal anomaly, which is not a disaster. It just means that you have to keep track of it when you transform the various tensors in the theory. But it's much more convenient to deal with the boundary, which is always flat. So PBH stands for Penrose, Brown, and Penol. And they showed that if I take a boundary of an asymptotically anti-de-Sitter spacetime, and if I perform a wild transformation on that boundary, what that corresponds to is a specific coordinate transformation in the bulk. Okay,
this is an illustration of a Penrose-Brown-Hanau transformation. This is a coordinate transformation in the bulk. So what it has done is that, so far as the boundary is concerned, it has rescaled the boundary by a factor of ETDF. The only reason why this is useful is that this will actually give us a way to find new, more interesting solutions which are time dependent. And let me describe that first. Put this up and bring that down. This way, this way. I think this place up should some consideration for short. So this is what we call the null solutions. So now I'll describe time-dependent solutions.
Okay, but how will you generate time dependency?
I will not generate. It's a different solution. I'm not going to do with this one.
Okay.
This is just a trick to
to find those solutions, because it might have some interesting implications from the point, we will find that there's some interesting implications from the point of four-dimensional cosmology. So let me talk about this general strategy of finding solutions. What I'm trying to do is to copy this form of the Einstein frame metric, namely, you can always go to a gauge where this z squared is a coefficient which is 1. But the special thing about this is that this conformal factor is not a function of z.
So we try to find solutions of the following form. This is the Einstein frame metric. The dilaton is a function of only x and not of z, and the five-form field is standard. It's easy to check that this will solve 10-dimensional supergravity if the Ricci tensor, which is obtained from that metric, it's a four-dimensional Ricci tensor, is equal to half, and the dilaton satisfies its own equation of motion. So all you got to do is to find some four-dimensional solutions of four-dimensional dilaton gravity. These are four-dimensional equations. Once you find any solution of four-dimensional dilaton gravity, you have a solution of 10-dimensional supergravity with five forms, which are asymptotical areas. That's a trick. So having said that, that's better. Let's try to find solutions which are time dependent. The simplest solutions, where these are all functions of time rather than x plus, are actually solutions which are Kastner. It's not entirely unexpected. I'll call them Kastner solutions. So generally, these anything with a tilde is the four-dimensional part of that metric. So that's going to be like this. Standard Kastner. Of course, this is solving Einstein equation with an energy momentum tensor. So this is a solution if pi is equal to 1, and so typically, if one is solving source-free Einstein equations, sum of pi is equal to 1 and sum of pi square equal to 1. Now we have an energy momentum tensor, which is due to the dilaton. So the sum of pi square is related to the solution for the dilaton. Okay. A specially interesting case, we don't know how to do anything very much with this most general form of the solution. A special case is something which we can say something about. All the PIs are equal for all I, in which case you can perform a coordinate transformation to write this in, and I'll just put in a mod because the solution doesn't make sense, t equal to 0. There's obviously a space-like singularity of a genuine kind at t equal to 0. The space-like singularity is also there. Of course, it's already there in the boundary theory, and it's but it's conformal. The boundary metric is conformal, and the singular part is out here. And
it's
your theory becomes, your dilaton becomes stronger and stronger as you
absolutely.
Go through.
Absolutely. Right. So this is not our dream model.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll give you a slightly better dream model than this bit. So, okay. But I tell you why this could be interesting. Even if I is not bounded, as you pointed out, so this is not the kind of things we will discuss the physics in. However, this is a kind of a warm-up case for the one which will follow.
Well, since this four-dimensional part of metric is conformally flat, P, B, and H tells you that in the bulk, I should be able to go to a coordinate system where the boundary is actually flat. Once the boundary is actually flat, then maybe I can define a Young-Mills theory on the flat bound, on a flat space-time, and with a time-dependent coupling. Still not very good, because the coupling is still not going to be bounded. Okay. But nevertheless, let's pursue that. And I will not bore you with the details of that transformation. It turns out that my collaborator, Adel Awad, is a kind of wizard with this kind of thing. So he actually found an exact transformation. Yeah, we actually don't need to find the exact transformations. It's good enough to find the transformations near the boundary. But OK, he's smart. So he found the exact transformations. And with that transformations, here is the exact form of the five-dimensional metric. And as you can see, I mean, I don't have any intuition of how he found it. But he just came to my office. I mean, I was trying to do a expansion around the boundary, and he came to my office and said, here is the answer. So I put it on maple and checked that, yes, this is right. Where these things come from. I think some of these numbers can be reduced to one by suitable rescalings. I think it has got to do with the fact that, you know, this part can be T, but also 16 times T, it doesn't really matter. So I think, you know, I think that's where these things come from. And e to the phi is given by T to the square root of 3. So the boundary at rho equal to 0 is flat. And as you can see, that all the subleading terms just go like rho square, at least in this. So you put rho equal to 0, of course, this whole thing just becomes 16 square is 256, t square whole square is t to the 4, and so on and so forth. And and we might say that, well, how about using putting this kind of a coupling constant? So you would think that this would correspond to, and that's probably true for all the times, that G Young-Mills square of T is just going to be T. This is some new time. Just T to the square root of 3, because that's the one which I take the dilaton, restrict it on the boundary at rho equal to 0.
The coupling is dimensionless, and so this T is dimensionless.
Yeah, this is dimensionless. This is the dimension. So there is a scale here, which has the
radius.
Yeah. Okay, but as I emphasize, this is not what we want. But Casper type singularity is sort of interesting. In some sense, they're sort of generic. So you might ask, is it possible to embed this in a to get a solution which is of the type we want, namely the coupling is always bounded, but near the singularity behaves like Casper.
So I'll present a class of solutions which are exactly like that. For reasons which will become clear, I'll call them FRW solutions.
Okay.
There are many ways in which you write this solution. It will not be clear why in this way of writing it is FRW. So first let me write it down in a form where the boundary metric is conformally flat, as is obvious from here. And these are, eta is kind of a Minkowski time on the boundary, r is a radial coordinate in three-dimensional space. If you require, of course, there are hordes and hordes of solutions. You can try to find with just these things turned on. We are not even turning on, just to keep things simple, we are not turning on any other field in supergravity. Just want to keep things simple. So let's require all these functions to be of the boosting of the Lorentz invariant, this quantity, rho squared minus tau squared. And then you can go to Milne type coordinates. Namely, you can write and then this becomes so then I'll just tell you what that solution is and put it a box under it. Tau equal to zero is the singularity. Okay. The thing that's going to matter for the Young-Mills theory is actually the dilaton. And as you can see that tau equal to one is the singularity, is a space-like singularity. I'll tell you. So, of course, there's a singularity at tau equal to 1. So, you've got to extend this thing. So, I'll draw a little picture of what these coordinates are. These are Milne type coordinates. So, they have to be sort of suitably extended. So, this is gone. So, is this. Eta and r are Minkowski type coordinates. So, if you plot eta and r this way. So the lines of constant tau are like this. So there is one tau that corresponds to tau equal to one. This null line corresponds to tau equal to zero. So this is sort of doing the universe in this, in the boundary. This is it doing the universe in the lower Milne wedge. But of course, that solution can be extended over to the other Milne wedge as well. But what we'll be really interested in is the singularity out here and try to ask the question, can we go across it or not? So I think this is sufficient, so those coordinates are quite sufficient. As tau goes to one, you can see that this thing just becomes tau to the square root of three, which is exactly like the Kastner solution which you obtain. In fact, you can check that as you approach the singularity along these lines like that, I mean, the departures of the metric away from Kastner also are sort of subleading. So towards the singularity, it's becoming pretty close to Kastner solutions. The reason why, you might wonder why am I calling them FRW solutions, that's because there is yet another coordinate system in which this five-dimensional metric can be written as, so let me just write the four-dimensional part, can be written as k equal to minus one. Yep. Something conformal to the k equal to minus one FRW. That's why we call them FRW solutions. In these coordinates, t equal to zero is the singularity. In fact, you can check that if if I replace this function by e to the 2t, this metric is just a black metric.
E to the 5t goes to delta tau to the square root of 3, the deviation of tau from 1.
That was not your answer. Sorry. Yes. I'm sorry.
So you said that tau equal to 0 is the norm?
Tau equal to 0 is this. So we think of approaching this bit. So this is like, this line is like
tau equal to minus 10 to the 500. That's where we start off. The thing is, it sort of evolves like that. This is where it becomes singular, and this little part is of course an infinite part, and the tau equal to 0 is the, if you wish, the infinite past, infinite future, right? Okay. So let's start talking about the dual theory. Now, one of the things we wanted to have in this entire scenario is to keep things as simple as you want. In particular, we did not want to have a boundary at Young-Mills theory, which is itself described on a singular boundary. That is why we went through this pain of doing this PBH transformations and obtaining a flat boundary. It's not that it is disastrous to do something on a curved boundary, because the underlying theory is sort of conformal invariant. So if you are very, very careful of keeping track of anomalous transformation properties, you will be able to do it. But this is much simpler. The other thing we wanted to have is, in this entire scenario, we wanted to start off the gauge theory in its vacuum state, so that asymptotically, what you have, the bulk geometry, is just pure ADS5 cross S5. Okay. Now, sometimes it becomes a little, yes.
Can I ask a question about the setup? So, so at early times you want to use the gravity description, and at some moment of time you want to switch to gauge theory, and then vice versa. Okay. So is it obvious that it's okay to make a cut at a certain moment of time and then start using the gauge theory? Because the boundary behavior then will be determined by lots of different times in the bulk, I guess, and vice versa. So.
No, certainly not. It's certainly, if you were a super person, of course, if I were a super person, I will just deal with the gauge theory and not talk about anything else. I will interpret the gauge theory in a space-time fashion at early times, and I'll be done with it. Okay. But here, what is that? We don't, of course, know how to deal with strongly coupled gauge theories. I mean, to calculate anything in strongly coupled gauge theories, particularly in situations where you have sources which are time dependent. It turns out that the sources are null dependent, they have the supersymmetries, but that's actually useless. I mean, null supersymmetries, as you very well know, are not that useful. So what we are saying, that in the very far past, we can think of the time evolution as a solution of supergravity equations of motion, right?
Gravity solution is not determined just by the early time behavior of the gauge theory, right? I mean, if you want to reconstruct the early time of the bulk, you need information from many places of the boundary, including late time, I guess.
Well, no, see, it's like posing an initial value problem. You start off with an initial surface.
In the bulk or on the boundary?
In the bulk. So you specify the fields and their derivatives, and you evolve that. Of course, that's not what we do. I mean, we actually find the full solution. Right. But you can view the full solution as a solution of the initial value problem. And that's the way we are trying to view it. So you're right. I mean the full solution, of course, is what it is. It is already given you the time evolution. Okay. So you want to make sure that you are not excited by putting in that this gravity. I mean, since we are not actually following what I professed, namely, first turn order source and then figure out what happened to the supergravity. But we did the other way around. We started with the supergravity and figured out what does it mean in the gauge theory. We wanted to make sure that we haven't inadvertently excited the gauge theory in some fashion. You don't want to excite the gauge theory beyond its vacuum state. One diagnostic for doing that is to calculate, for example, the energy momentum tensor of the gauge theory and see whether it is zero or non-zero in the asymptotic past.
And it would be interesting to see how this thing actually behaves as a function of time. Of course, in the early past, we don't have any tools of calculating the energy momentum tensor directly in the gauge theory, but that's why ADS-CFT is there. We want to calculate the energy momentum tensor by what is called a holographic stress tensor in the bulk. So let me briefly describe that calculation and give you the results.
Can the time dependence be just dimensional analysis in this case?
No, it's not really. It's just kind of a scaling solution only near singularities. I mean, that's where the Kastner thing is. I think away from that, so there is a scale at which, you know, this thing actually is turning down, you know, like where.
It must be ADS related scale.
No. This is a scale which you choose. Actually, this tau is a dimensionless time.
It should be related to the time divided by, I guess it's the ADS scale, right? And some one of the coordinate transformations that you
No, it's apart from that. I've chosen the ADS scale to have hidden another. These things are all just T by Q whole square. You know, T by Q is some. You know, it tells you, so the, you know, the coupling constant is sort of constant in the past and then turning down, right? So there has to be a scale which tells you where it is doing so. It is that scale. I've just chosen that to be, I shouldn't have done that actually. So every time you see tau equal to 1, it should be tau equal to q or something.
Somehow it's not fixed by equation number.
It's not fixed by the equation's portion. Once it is fixed here, it's fixed out there, but otherwise. Okay, so let me remind you of the calculation of the energy momentum tensor. Erase my collaborators.
Sorry, can I just ask, the boundary theory has a singularity or not? Phi?
The boundary theory.
The phi is going to exactly zero, right?
When it's going to exactly zero, but it becomes a weakly coupled gauge theory. We will find, however, that doesn't guarantee that the boundary theory is smooth. Okay, that's we'll come a little bit later on. Things can depend on derivatives of phi. I mean, that's what the danger is. Okay. If it does, we'd like to find out what is the signature. If it doesn't, well, good. Okay, so the way one calculates the energy momentum tensor in this holographic method is that you start with the bulk action. Surface term, part dimensional Newton constant, some units where the cosmological constant is 12 or whatever. Where theta is the extrinsic curvature scalar on the boundary, and h is the induced metric on the boundary. This is the standard action of general relativity plus dilettantes in this case. And so what you do is take one of the solutions, plug it this thing into the action, take a derivative with respect to the boundary metric, which is the induced metric on the boundary, and that will give you what is called the Brown-York tensor. Of course. Yes, so that's of course the thing will diverge, right? And of course the standard technique is to recognize that this divergence is nothing but the gauge theory, the standard ultraviolet divergence which is present in the gauge theory.
And so you regulate this by adding some counter terms, and this you have to figure out. I mean, we have to figure out for ourselves because people haven't done this calculation completely with a dilaton. So the form of the counter term, which removes all these divergences, is an integral over the boundary, and it just turns out to be 3. This is the Ricci scalar calculated with H, this is the minimal subtraction, if you wish. Log of where rho zero is a cutoff, which is, you know, if rho zero is going to zero, you just go to the boundary and that's
okay. It determines these counter terms.
It's like any other counter terms, you cancel off all the divergence in the theory. So different finite pieces correspond to different renormalization schemes of the data.
And so the special thing in your case is that you have the delta phi.
Right. The only new aspect of our case is that we have the phi. It so turns out that people have calculated the conformal anomaly in this case, but not all components of the energy momentum tensor. But we just redid the calculation anyway. Okay. Okay. So we were
the theory of the boundary was n equal 4.
N equal 4 deformed with the source term.
But which preserves n equal 4.
No. No, it breaks supersymmetry.
It breaks because of the time dependence, yeah. Not the form of the potential, just the coefficient.
No, definitely. It's the time dependence.
So it's that which gives you a divergence, because otherwise n equal 4 doesn't have any divergence.
Well, actually, even for n equal to 4, there would be a divergence.
Yeah, once you can do the
small space, you have to add counter terms to make things finite.
There's no coupling constant renormalization, right, but there can be wave function.
So this would be a wave function?
This kind of corresponds to wave function. In this case, also a coupling constant, because you can see that there are some delta phi's involved here. I'm not completely sure about the interpretation of that in the case.
Right.
So we'll do the calculation in two different choices of the boundary. One is a choice of the boundary where the boundary metric is conformal to flat space. And the other is the choice of the boundary where the boundary metric is just flat. So for that, I omitted something. I should tell you how to go from here to a set of coordinates where the boundary metric is flat. Well, I'll not tell you that, since this is conformally flat, and since P, B, and H tell you that a wild transformation on the boundary is some coordinate transformation in the bulk, so you can sort of painfully perform that coordinate transformation around the boundary and obtain at a form where the boundary metric is flat. Okay. Of course, you need the subleading terms in order to calculate the energy momentum tensor, but since these are ugly, I'll not do that. So I'll just write it here that use PBH transformations. So this is followed. So use let me just write a few terms. Doesn't harm. Go to coordinates rho, which I'll call rho and t, from z and tau. And in terms of that, you can write down the metric. That's the standard part. Right. That's right. So you need all that. So for the dilaton is, I don't even have that. You know, it becomes a phi of t and rho now. And where is it? Something. Doesn't matter. Okay. Okay. So what you do is you choose the counter terms. This has been chosen precisely to cancel all the divergences. And then you consider the following object, which is the Brown-York stress tensor. So I'll call T
T mu nu without any brackets around it as 2 upon square root of H H mu nu, where I is I bulk and the ADS CFT correspondence then claims that whatever, so this is some solution in the in supergravity, so it corresponds to either a state or a source or both in the gauge theory. So whatever that state is, the ADS CFT correspondence tells you that the expectation value of the stress tensor in the gauge theory, in the Young-Mills theory, times, so let me write the equation properly. Mu nu, this is the boundary metric G mu nu, and then square root of G. So this is an entirely an object in the gauge theory. If you are able, just do the calculation. If you are not able and you're in the right regime, the area CFT correspondent tells you that this is going to be where this T is the same as that T, and let me call it Brown-York. We want to calculate this, especially at early times, to see what is the answer. And there, we have some results, all of which we don't understand. Yeah.
Good. One, with the choice of boundary, which is conformally flat, it turns out, and I haven't given you the expression for the energy momentum tensor, it's the wrong expression for what you get out of, you know, doing this and out of this calculation. What you find is this object, which is equal to this, is always zero. Both for any solution, which is the function of plus, function of time, or what have you, so long as it satisfies those equations of four-dimensional Dirac-Lorentz gravity.
That's very weird, because you will expect the trace anomaly to be present here, right? Because you have a, so somehow this Dirac-Lorentz is, I mean, the time-dependent coupling is canceling exactly the trace anomaly.
The Dirac-Lorentz, you know that. So typically what happened, if you didn't have the Dirac-Lorentz, it could be non-zero. It's a Dirac-Lorentz piece that cancels this.
Is it an intuitive way of seeing that will happen, or is it?
I don't completely understand it, but all I know, if you take that expression for the energy momentum tensor and plug in those equations, which are R mu nu equal to half.
I mean, from the gauge theory point of view.
Oh, from the gauge theory point of view, I think what's happening is that there's a time dependence of the coupling constant, time or X plus dependence of the coupling constant. That can be a source of a trace anomaly as well.
Right.
And that exactly cancels in this particular case. It doesn't always cancel, come off.
But this is stronger than that. It says that stress tensor, expectation value of the stress tensor is zero, not just its trace.
Yeah, that's right. It's a stress tensor is zero.
At all times or just at that point?
At all times.
At all times it's
so, but that's
don't you think that maybe there's a coordinate transformation that takes this particular solution to just pure ADS? Yes.
If I take the particular solution to be pure ADS?
No. This solution might be pure ADS by some complicated coordinate transformation.
No, it's not.
It's not pure.
No, it's not. I mean, for example, you know, the if you calculate the five-dimensional Ricci scalar, it's not.
Okay.
More interestingly, this is not what we are interested in. We are interested in for the situation when the choice of the boundary is actually flat and not conformally flat. And there what we find is something. There is a little bit of more intuition because it's like only in the gauge theory, only the coupling constant is sort of turned on. So for choice of boundary, which is just plain flat,
what we find for all times when the solution is null, namely phi is just a function of x plus. Now that you can see, because if you look at the expression for the energy momentum tensor, you need to do some contractions, and this is one of the stupid facts that when everything depends on a null coordinate, then what happens is there aren't enough indices to contract it. It also tells you that even though the things are more under control, there possibly suddenly the null singularities are not as interesting as the others. Because if you look at time and the one which depends on time, the answer, in fact, for time dependent solutions you will for that particular solution in the coordinates which I have just erased. So let me write down what the answer is. Times a diagonal matrix. This is for what we call the FRW solution.
Capital T or
no? So capital T is the coordinate.
So can you read out the equation of state, for example, from this? The equation of state, like the P components, this one third.
Yeah, I guess so. So this is rho, these are P's.
Yeah.
Something.
Nothing special.
Nothing very special, it looks like.
Wait, so
because you had this region where gauge theory was weakly coupled.
Right.
A good measure to measure how weakly coupled the theory is to look at its equivalent state and see whether it grows like one third. Right. You're just talking about a gas of Yang Mills expansions,
you know? Yeah. So that would be one third, but this is not valid at in that regime.
Oh, it's not valid.
This is a calculation in the ADS. It's only valid at early times. In fact, this shows some singularity at t equal to 1. I don't know anything about this, for this expression is not really valid. What could be valid is, in fact, the trace of this, because the trace is sometimes protected. I mean, there are some confusing things in the literature about this. You know, Fratkin and Seitlin many, many years ago, in fact, calculated the trace anomaly of such theories, which are n equal to 4 theories coupled to what is called conformal supergravity. And they just wrote down an expression. I didn't quite understand how it is done, but that actually agrees with the trace of whatever expression we get. So the trace anomaly could be something real and could possibly is reproducible by a bottom-up calculation in the gauge theory.
So, could you remind us why you can't?
Because this is a calculation I did using supergravity, and near capital T equal to 1, supergravity is breaks down.
Oh, sure, that was, yeah, that this is the singularity.
This is a singularity.
Yeah.
But you don't have an R squared term, so why are you?
You mean R squared term in the.
Well, Seitlin and Falkin, when you talk about conformal gravity, had R squared.
They had R squared, but they also had a Taylor term coupled to it. You know, when they talk about, so the conformal gravity has many fields in it. In particular, there is a Taylor term, and this is as what the thing they consider is coupling those fields to the n equal to 4 Young-Mills theory and calculating trace in the Young-Mills theory. That was the calculation.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Actually, just to get some insight on the result, what is capital T equals 0 correspond to? What region in space-time?
Capital T equal to 0 corresponds
in that range,
a place beyond the singularity. So capital T equal to minus infinity is early times.
Okay.
Capital T equal to tending to 1 is the singularity. And capital T equal to 0 is beyond which don't really want to talk about.
The early times, the energy density is negative?
It's outside the...
No, the early time, the energy density is 0.
Could it be there is a sign in the diagonal? The trace would vanish if there would be a minus sign somewhere on the 12 or something.
Oh, that's actually interesting. Yeah, that's actually true, yeah. It's some negative. Because there's a minus sign here.
Yeah. So you need some, maybe the sign is opposite?
It's possible, I messed up. I'm not sure. It does go to 0 as a power of 1 upon infinity. Okay. Okay. Now, time is sort of, so I should finish by 10:45 or something like that, right? Okay. Right? So let's talk now, finally, about the dual gauge theory and what can we say about it. The nicest thing, as you would expect, what we can say about it is in the case where the singularity is null, where we believe we have some, I mean, a fair level of control. We also believe that we have some control over the time-dependent case, but we are not completely, you know, sure about the conclusions in this case. But I'll tell you to whatever extent we could progress in this case. Where did I keep all those?
It's just here.
Oh, there it is. Okay, there's one is on the board.
So we're going to consider Young-Mills theories, which have some coupling, which depends on time or some null coordinates. We're going to consider this in the regime when the coupling is very small, right? But that doesn't, as we will see immediately, that doesn't really mean that things are all okay. And the reason is that what is really small is the overall term in front of the Lagrangian density. Or in other words, the Young-Mills theory has overall e to the minus phi. Then there is a trace F square. There are the 6 scalar fields. Then some interactions. Let me write down what the heck the complete thing. This is a 10-dimensional Majorana spinner. This is a 10-dimensional gamma matrices. Mu runs from 0, 1, 2, 3, and ij run from 1 to 6. Covariant derivative psi, and then so this is the complete action. And I wrote it in the wrong place because I wanted to save it. Okay.
The coupling to the scalar, the Ricci scalar, and the 6 scalars of Young-Mills, the conformal coupling.
Oh no, this is on flat space.
Oh, this
is flat space. We're doing Poincaré force.
Oh, I thought you were doing the
Poincaré. Okay. Now, what do we normally do when we have such a thing where there is an overall 1 upon g square in the coupling? We make a field redefinition so that the kinetic term is canonical. You know, kinetic term is just 1, right? And of course, when you try to do that, you're going to get positive powers of e to the phi, which is the coupling. So the Young-Mills coupling square is e to the phi of x, and that's a function of x plus phi of x. And you get positive powers of g Young-Mills square
in all terms which are cubic and higher. But since this is a function of x, when you try to do the field redefinition, you will come up with derivatives of phi, derivatives of e to the phi. Okay? Now, if you were just derivatives of e to the phi, we don't have much of a problem, because the kind of solutions we have chosen can be chosen such that its derivatives of e to the phi are in fact smooth, right? What is not smooth are derivatives of phi. But as you can see, if I try to make a field redefinition like a mu going to e to the phi upon 2 a mu, the term which contains just two a's, any the quadratic terms in the Lagrangian, will actually have terms like e to the minus phi there, and then some derivative of e to the phi by 2 whole square. Okay? So what this means, that kinetic terms will generically contain just the derivative of the dilaton square, which is in fact singular. Okay? And we have to deal with these things. Okay. So let's see what are the kind of terms which would appear in this context. In fact, once we make sure that such terms are not present, or even if they are present are innocuous, then the interactions do not pose much of a problem, which is actually quite a bit funny, because the interactions will always have three powers of e to the phi upon 2, and there's an overall power of e to the minus phi. So if there is a derivative of phi, it will at least come with an exponential of phi upon 2, which is like derivative of e to the phi upon 2, which is bounded. So we have to look carefully at the kinetic terms in this theory. The fermion, luckily, doesn't create any problem, regardless of what. And that's because of the simple fact that if you take the fermion kinetic term, which is just this, what it becomes is under a rescaling of phi going to e to the phi upon 2 psi goes to so there is your derivative of phi which has appeared in here. But psi is a Majorana fermion, and gamma is a 10-dimensional gamma matrix, so this thing is identically zero. One way to see that is to choose a Majorana representation where all the gamma matrices are either real or pure imaginary. Then you can check that gamma zero gamma mu is always a symmetric matrix. Psi's are Grassmann, and in this representation, psi's are real. So this thing vanishes. This is of course the correct anyway for Majorana fermions. That correct would identically vanish. Such terms are present for the bosonic term in the bosonic part of the action. So what you get under a field redefinition of phi I going to e to the too many phi's, but I try to write capital phi's here, what it becomes is or in other words, it generically would lead to some space-time dependent mass terms, the time-dependent mass terms. Okay, this I have done this, I've just plugged this thing in and performed an integration by parts to get this result. Furthermore, for the gauge field, what you get by this technique is some f mu nu square. Did I write? I should put this. Yeah.
I don't know, like for example, classical particle production. In this case, you have massive
with counterpoint. Yeah.
Okay. And then you can compare it to your Timmy Nu and see. I don't know how, but that might. Yeah.
We'll come to that. That's the question. So let me first write down this.
Where is that? It's a long formula. This I want to keep up.
So the other way, because it would just as well have started without the gauge couplings in the covariant derivatives and done the free definition in the other way, then it would have all the kinetic terms for the electron in the original action and not in the final action. So what determines where the kinetic electron fields terms will appear?
Well, so what you're asking is that what told me that this is the action, right? So that's what the ADS safety correspondence is. The ADS safety correspondence tells you that the operator which is dual to the dilaton is the Lagrangian density itself. So think of expanding into the minus pi as 1 minus pi, so that's the part of the dilaton which is different from the constant. So that couples to the Lagrangian density, and that's what happens. That's an important point. Okay, let's examine this for clearly running out of time.
Could it be that for time-dependent cases, you have to revisit this? Because, as you say, when dilaton is constant, then it doesn't matter where you put it. You can either keep
it's a statement of when dilaton is not a constant. Because it's going to tell you what operators you should carry, calculate the correlation function of to produce a certain ADS thing. So in particular, as you know, Young-Mills calculation is always done in the free theory, so that term has to be there. Okay, I have to speed up a little bit, sorry. So, it's easy to check that when the dilaton is a function of a null coordinate, like x plus, all these extra terms vanish. Or not vanish for the scalar. The reason is that you have a grad phi whole square minus grad square phi, and those things are zero when phi depends only on a single null coordinate. The boundary thing is flat.
For the gauge fields, it's equally easy to check that if we choose a gauge A minus equal to zero, then these extra terms vanish as well. That's a slightly more difficult to see, but there are terms which are grad phi whole square and grad square phi which vanish, and then there are terms with grad mu phi, grad nu phi, and you can check that, since mu and nu can only be a plus and there's nothing upper with plus, so those terms also vanish. So if we try to quantize the theory in the light cone gauge and in light front quantization, it appears that the only place where x plus dependence is going to appear are in the interaction terms. And in those places, those coefficients are one which precisely go to zero at the singularity. It's truly becoming a weakly coupled gauge theory without any subtleties. Okay. Now, there could be other subtleties which comes from one loop, and maybe privately I can talk to you about that, but I don't want to mention that. But as far as we could see by examination in perturbation theory in one loop diagrams, there is nothing funny going about in this gauge theory. And so we would think that in this particular case of a null singularity, there's a very good chance that you'll be able to actually go through the singularity in using the gauge theory. I said there is a good chance because light cone gauge is notorious for having zero mode problems. So in particular, I mean, these, I mean, if you look at, when you fix the light cone gauge, not only do you have to plug it into an action, you have to look at the constraints. You can check the constraints and see that the constraints are, in fact, the standard constraints. But all the things work in the sector when the momentum is not zero. When the momentum is zero, there are huge subtleties. I must confess that we haven't looked at with great care at these subtleties. There could be a problem coming from there. If there is a problem, it would be interesting to trace it, because these problems are typically infrared, reflect some infrared problems of the gauge theory. As always, the time-dependent solutions are more interesting.
By
right.
Multiplying a master, right. So I'm looking to see if there is an instability of the type that Thomas and Ben talked. Is that sign, what do you know about
that? I'll come to that. The sign will turn out to be negative. I mean, it's tachyonic. So I'll come to that. Oh, you guys are actually
good to
wrap up. I'll just wrap it up in another 3 minutes. Okay.
So let's look at the time-dependent case. The mass square terms are always negative. You can actually find that I don't have much of an intuition for that, but there are these two classes we have considered, the Kastner and as well as the FRW. You can see that, you know, this is both for FRW and for Kastner. And you can check explicitly that if you take the FRW type solutions, go close to the singularity, it just becomes like the Kastner. So
we should suffer from similar problems. Instability.
Problems or not, I do not know. This will be an instability of the theory. Okay. But of course, what kind of instability? So one of the things, for example, this would mean in the absence of anything else, any cure of the type you guys did, it would mean that if this is time, if I prepare the state in an in vacuum, okay, so let me just illustrate this from Kastner.
You can solve the wave equation, of course, and we have seen many times in this conference. So, you know, the wave equation, say, for a phi just becomes square root of t times some Bessel function of kt to the I k dot x. Bessel function of 2 and its complex conjugate, and where nu is given by half of square root of 1 plus e by t square. It so happens that m square of t goes to, this is exactly true for Kastner and true near the singularity for the FRW case. And you can immediately check that if you prepare a state which is defined in terms of this positive energy modes, calculate correlation functions as you approach the singularity, those correlation functions actually diverge. So that's one signal that, you know, there's something, maybe something sick in the theory. You can ask, is there some other state in the theory in which the correlation functions are well defined? Very often that does happen. And yes, there is another state which is defined not in terms of the Hankel functions, but in terms of Bessel functions. But it appears to that state is actually not a normalizable state in the gauge theory. I mean, in terms of the gauge theory degrees of freedom. Okay. So it appears to us that if the situation was Kastner all the way through, there will be a problem of instability, and the gauge theory is probably sick, unless there is some cure to it. We don't have a complete analysis at the moment for the FRW case, because the mass square term goes to zero at infinity much faster in this case. It goes like t to the 8 or something like that. And we don't know that whether there is a state in the gauge theory such that the correlation functions in that state would sort of make sense even as you approach the singularity. But I think we do have the tools to analyze this problem. It's also a problem of bounded, you know, particle production, and as you go towards the singularity. So in conclusion, I think we have a fairly good case that null singularities are tameable in this fashion by using the ADS CFT correspondence. They are interesting somewhat in the sense that it does, you know, give a scenario in which some time seems to end in the bulk. So it sort of tells you that, well, nothing is really ending in the gauge theory. Possibly you can go through time evolution. It's a bit boring from other points of view because we're really interested in space-like singularities. I mean, not really in null singularities. But I believe that we have been able to develop the tools of the trade, which is good enough to say something about space-like singularities. We don't want to show that all space-like singularities are tamed by this fashion. If not, we would like to see what are the signatures of singularities which cannot be tamed in the gauge theory, because that will sort of teach us something about the nature of what is really happening at, you know, what one calls the beginning or the end of time. I'm sorry I went over time, but thank you for your attention.
Let's have two quick questions, and then we need a break so we'll keep on screen. Anyone with an urgent, urgent quick question? Somebody's calling. Somebody's calling with that.
No, this camera keeps ringing. Oh, the camera tries. That's what the thing is.
Yeah, somebody from up above.
London is the city which has the highest surveillance in the world,
right? So there are no quick questions. So let's break and let's thank Simon again.
Thank you.